Copper Shores Community Health Foundation is proud to introduce you to Do Good Volunteer of the Month, Wendy Matfolk, from the Barber Kettle Gunlock Shelter Home. Wendy has volunteered at the shelter since 1992. She has been dedicated to their cause against domestic violence throughout all these years, and her calming presence with residents and willingness to listen is a positive attribute to her volunteer work with the agency. If you know an incredible volunteer like Wendy, go to dogoodcc.org and nominate them to be recognized as the next Do Good in the Copper Country Volunteer of the Month.
Welcome back to segment two of Copper Country Today. I'm Todd Van Dyke. We're brought to you by the Copper Shores Community Health Foundation. It was a decade ago that we spent a lot of time talking about the 1913 copper strike because, of course, 10 years ago, it was the centennial of probably the biggest historical event that we have seen to date here in the Copper Country. 10 years has now passed, and we're talking about it a little bit again because it's the 110th anniversary thereof, and because there is an effort underway to erect a statue to honor one of the strike leaders, Big Annie Clements, in Calumet. I thought it'd be a good idea to check in with Steve Leto. Steve is the author of the book Death's Door, which is pretty much the definitive telling and investigation into the Italian Hall tragedy that was part of the 1913 copper strike, and generally an expert in the strike in general as well. So, Steve Leto, it's been a while since we've talked, but welcome back to Copper Country Today.
It's good to be here. One of my favorite places to talk about this.
Your family, of course, has roots here in the Copper Country, although you don't live here, but that Leto name, you've got roots that came from here. Is that what got you interested in this in the first place?
Yes, and, you know, that's actually an interesting tie-in right there because, you know, obviously Finlandia University folding recently. My grandfather was a dean of Suomi College until 1963, and my father and mother lived in Hancock for a while. I've got five brothers who were born there. I was actually born downstate, but you know, all my relatives were up there, spent every summer up there. And at family gatherings, family reunions, especially when the older generation was around, if they started talking about things, they would occasionally mention the Italian Hall disaster. And so I don't know there was a time in my life where I had not heard the phrase or known about the event. I didn't understand it completely until I did a lot of research on it. But it's something that is, you know, I tell people that the Finnish community, it's something that just everyone's aware of on some level, you know?
Yeah, it's certainly a part of our history here in the Copper Country. But as I recall, when you first started digging into this, you encountered some resistance from some of the locals because there were myths associated with this that it became pretty obvious as you did your research weren't exactly true.
Well, and there's a couple aspects to that. Some of them were simply like, for instance, the story that the doors opened the wrong way. And I think now everybody's pretty much on board with the fact that the doors, the base, the stairs opened outward. And I mean, I think that's we finally put that one to rest. But I mean,
well,
there was a time
you found pictures. I mean, it's pretty hard to refute that when you have actual pictures of the building.
Yeah, you know, you'd think so, but I had people saying that maybe those pictures were taken by somebody else. I mean, we put that to rest. I mean, there was a time when the historical marker at the site actually said the doors opened the wrong way.
Yeah.
And so I can tell you that as a historian, I have a degree in history and I've written 12, 15 books, something like that. I've actually gotten several historical markers rewritten. And you know, when they carve something in stone, it's hard to change it. Now, the marker at the site wasn't in stone. It was cast aluminum, I think, but we got that changed. But that was one of them. But unfortunately, the strike is what divided the community. And because the Italian Hall disaster happened during the strike, a lot of the sides that were drawn before the disaster kind of colored how you viewed the disaster itself. And so there was, of course, a lot of people in Calumet who were on strike because they're striking miners. And then there's a lot of people who weren't favoring the strike. Besides mine management, a lot of the local businesses, for instance, didn't like the strike. And so there were battle lines drawn long before the Italian Hall disaster. So when the Italian Hall disaster happened, a lot of people said, well, this was the fault of mine management because, you know, they're putting up such a resistance to what we're demanding. And then there's a lot of people going, well, it's not mine management's fault that the disaster happened. And so a lot of those feelings never went away. And so I have encountered people in the last 10 years, in the last 15 years, going back when I started researching this, who clearly have hard feelings about what happened, and they almost looks like they've carried these feelings forward. And now, you know, people who were at the Italian Hall disaster, I interviewed a woman who was there, but she was close to 100 years old when I talked to her. So there aren't that many people around now who were still there, but people pass this stuff down through the generations. And so I wasn't there, and I obviously come to it from the side that's sympathetic towards the workers, because I had a great-grandfather who worked in the mines. And so I've always kind of, in my mind, sided with them.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people who came down through from the other side kind of view it like, well, the Italian Hall disaster is a tragedy that happened, but it had nothing to do with the strike. And, it, you know, and so I have encountered some people who are just kind of wanting this to go away, and they wish that people would stop talking about it. And I really, as a historian again, hate to ever think we'll stop talking about something that was important. And 73 people died.
Yes.
73. 60 of them were children. Half of them were Finnish. So the Finns will never forget this. And people really need to look at that and go, wait, 60 children died. That's a very, very serious event. And I'm not saying that you've got to agree with my take on who might be at fault, but you simply cannot forget the event. That's the real key here.
Well, and fault kind of became a negligible thing. And I think you and I talked about this once before. The story, of course, goes that somebody stuck their head in while the party was going on upstairs at the Italian Hall and yelled fire. You're an attorney, so you know more about this kind of thing than I do. But I don't know that anybody who did that could have possibly envisioned the tragedy that resulted.
Right. And there's a distinction to be made as to what a person's intent is when they're charged with a crime resulting from their actions. And so somebody who would yell fire in a crowded theater filled with children wouldn't be intending to kill anybody, most likely. However, they're doing what's clearly a reckless act. And everyone knows you don't falsely yell fire in a crowded theater.
Yeah.
That saying arose later as Oliver Wendell Holmes writing in a Supreme Court opinion who said that. But the point is that if you do something reckless and someone dies as a result, trust me, you can be prosecuted for that. And so I know a lot of people who got upset because I referred to the event as a mass murder. I wasn't saying that the person did it to intentionally kill people, but I was saying that in the sense that if they had caught the person at the time, they could have prosecuted them for all those deaths. And it probably would have been a form of manslaughter or something like that.
Something like that. Yeah. The other thing, myth that I think that was pretty quickly disproved in your research came from the song that Woody Guthrie recorded, and that came from an account by one of
Bloor.
The...
Pardon? Mother Bloor.
Yeah, Mother Bloor.
Yeah.
Yeah, that came from an account that there were actually mine strike breakers standing at the door preventing people from leaving.
Yeah, and there was a bunch of variations on that. Some people said the doors were chained shut. I've seen a guy who said that the firemen who showed up had to chop the doors open because they were so sealed. And the first people who got to the scene could open the doors fine. They just couldn't get the people out of the stairs. But yeah, so Mother Reeve Bloor wrote an account of the disaster in a book that she wrote called We Are Many. And Woody Guthrie read her account of it, was so moved that he wrote the song 1913 Massacre about it. And he adopted her telling of the story. And although I think her account is very important, it's unclear how accurate it was and whether or not she was even there, because she claimed that she was on stage when the cry of fire went up, and yet nobody mentions her being there. And so I've read her book, of course, and her book contains some facts that are clearly off a little bit. And so I think her book was designed to drum up support for the unions and the workers. And then when Woody Guthrie read it, he wrote a song to try to, you know, turn that into an anthem. And he got a lot of the story right, but he said that, you know, they're holding the door shut, which is not true. He said the workers only made a dollar, which is not true. So, you know, but he was a musician. He was not a historian.
Well, and he looked at the account and had no reason necessarily to disbelieve it. Ella Reeve Bloor leaves a bad taste in my mouth after looking at the way that she acted here during the strike. And she, of course, was the one who brought Big Annie Clements out on the road for a tour to try to drum up support. She strikes me, though, as being more a self-promoter than somebody who was really interested in the workers here. Is that the impression that you got, or am I wrong?
No, I think you're right. And it was very, very clear, because even in her account of coming to Calumet and meeting with Annie Clements, she described it as if Annie was a dyed-in-the-wool communist and was talking all about how Annie would march in front of these big parades holding a big red flag. And I've got photographs of Big Annie holding a big flag, and it's an American flag.
Yes.
And Big Annie was proudly waving this gigantic American flag and saying, this is America, and I love America, and as an American, I've got a right to do these things. And so I think Ellery Bloor really kind of twisted that a little bit, but Big Annie Clements was a patriot. She really was. She was obviously on the side of the workers because her husband was a striking worker. And she decided to both figuratively and literally pick up the flag and march on his behalf and all the other striking miners.
Yeah, and of course, that tour that she went out on, and again, it's kind of hard to figure out how she was feeling about things, but I got the impression that she didn't really want to go in the first place and got very tired of it very quickly and wanted to get back home. And eventually she did disengage and come back home, because it didn't do much to raise funds or awareness for what was going on here in the area. So I've always looked at Ella Reeve Bloor as being kind of an opportunist who took advantage perhaps a bit of Annie Clements.
Yeah, and, you know, Annie Clements, clearly, after the Italian Hall disaster happened, you could tell that like, broke her spirit, because after that, she did not talk a lot about what happened, and she did, you're right, go on tour briefly with Ella Reeve Bloor, but you could just tell that, like, she was one of the driving forces behind organizing that party.
Yes.
And it turned into this catastrophe. And so I think at that point, it's kind of like, I think it overwhelmed a lot of people, but it overwhelmed her probably with some of that guilt. Not that she deserved to feel guilty, but I think she did. I think she thought, like, I was on stage when this happened. And so, you know, afterwards she moved to Chicago, and she was involved in some labor stuff in Chicago, but I mean, she left the area not long after the disaster. So I think clearly she had the wind taken out of her sails by that.
How could that not affect you, even though it was obviously not her fault? How could the deaths of that many people and that many children not make leave a lifelong scar?
Yeah, no, and you know something? This is something we hear about disasters on TV. We watch movies. You know, you watch the movie Titanic, and you know Rose and Jack are out on that piece of driftwood. And in reality, it's difficult for people who've never been through things like this to describe it. I got to tell you the story about Mihelsic. The Mihelsic family, they lost three boys at the Italian Hall. And the father was this big, rugged miner who'd gotten involved in some fights with some strike breakers earlier in the strike. And they'd made the papers. They described these events where Joe Mihelsic was facing off with these strike breakers, this big hulk giant of a man. And I read a report of a reporter who came in on the evening of the Italian Hall disaster, and they were laying the bodies out of the victims before they had identified any of them. And the guy goes, I came around the corner, and I saw a grown man on his hands and knees next to a dead child crying like a baby. And I realized that was Joe. That was Joe Mihelsic.
Yeah,
that was the father.
There was an article, a note in my notes the other day. Early on in the strike, he was one of those who actually was arrested for carrying dynamite in the very early days of the strike, and was threatening to blow himself up and others around him, and they talked him down from that. And yet this was the man who months later was just prostrated with grief because of the deaths of his children, and just heartbreaking.
And I can't imagine that. So anybody who's got children, count how many children you've got and do the math on how many more there were at the Italian Hall. And put that much death and tragedy in one small location like that, in one tight-knit community like that. Even though there's a strike at the time, everybody knew somebody whose children or whose neighbor's children got killed that night. And, you know, you look at the addresses on the death certificates, for instance, and there's up and down the street, there's literally people from this house, people from the next door house, people from the, you know, I mean, it's crazy. Calumet was a very, very large town. It's called Red Jacket, of course, at the time, but it was also a small town in how everyone knew everybody.
Talking with Steve Leto, he's the author of Death's Door, which is the story of the Italian Hall tragedy, which was part of the 1913 copper strike narrative, which was getting underway 110 years ago at this time. And I guess, Steve, it's says something about how viciously these two sides opposed each other, that a tragedy like this couldn't serve as a method for them to come together and solve things.
Well, and that's one of the things a lot of people assumed would happen. They thought, okay, the community will pull together. But there were simply too many people who said, you know, we need to know who did this. And until we know who did it, you know, we think we know. And you had a lot of finger pointing back and forth. And that's the unfortunate part. I do think it's thing I know you're going to bring up, but Big Annie, she's been honored a little bit over the years. She's a member of the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame. There's a really good book about her by a guy named Lyndon Comstock that came out a few years ago, a very, very good biography of her. But really, she was somebody I think that deserves more recognition and more to remember her by. Because when you tell the story of the Italian Hall, you know, stories aren't about things and events. They're about people. And if you wanted to pick important people, Big Annie is certainly one of those people who needs to be remembered.
And that was one question I was going to ask, Steve, because history tends sometimes to focus on certain people and not focus on other people. And sometimes we take people who weren't terribly important and raise them up. And sometimes we take people who were terribly important and ignore them. She, right. You believe, deserves the credit and the spotlight that she's gotten.
And you have to understand the will of this woman who, think about 1913. Women were supposed to be in the homes taking care of, you know, the kids and making meals for their husbands. And while her husband's on strike, she's out there leading the strikers down Main Street, carrying a flagpole 10 feet tall with a gigantic American flag on it. And every single reporter, because a lot of reporters came from around the country to cover the strike when it first started, were shocked that they'd see this woman. By the way, she's a striking figure to look at. She's pretty, and she's over 6 feet tall.
Yeah.
And so I'm 6 foot two, and I would often get in front of audiences and go, by the way, I think she was taller than me. And she was a tall woman. They call her Big Annie, but she's actually tall. And she's very pretty, but she's carrying this ostentatious, gigantic flag on a gigantic flagpole at every occasion. And she became the face of the strike. And these strikes were not always peaceful events, the parades. People would you know, there'd be stuff thrown back and forth, and people would talk about the strikers. People would be throwing stuff at them, too. I mean, there, you know, so she was, you know, she made herself a target, and she's leading these strikes. And it's just such a thing to think about 110 years later. Nowadays, you might go, a woman making a stand in public, that's not that big of a deal. Back then, it was a big deal.
It was, and she spent a night or two in jail because of it,
yeah.
And she wasn't the only one. Women took a very active role in this strike. There were other women who harassed the strike breakers, who at some point pitched the contents of their chamber pots on them as they went to work. I don't want to think about that, but this was,
right.
she was not the only woman who took a real activist role in this.
Well, and I think that she was, in a roundabout way, she was actually helping rally them as well. If you think about a typical family, you've got a father and a mother and a couple kids. And back then, the father's probably the breadwinner. So when he goes on strike and he's out marching around, what do the wife and kids do? You know, and so some of them might go along. And I've seen photographs of these parades, and they've often got, you know, women and children in the parades also.
Yes.
But to be standing out front, carrying that flag, and basically saying, like, I am the one who's going to be the face of this, she became a lightning rod. There's the famous incident where she got in the confrontation with the National Guard, and the National Guardsman ordered her off the street. And she said, no, this is America. I'm on the street. You're on the street. We can both be here. And the guardsman swung a sword and knocked her flag out of her hands, and he hit her hand with the sword. We've got a photograph of her bandaged hand as she's standing in front of the Michigan National Guardsman. And later, investigation, and the state investigated why this National Guardsman knocked an American flag to the ground. And didn't ask the bigger question, why would you swing a sword at a woman in broad daylight?
Yeah.
So... But, I mean, that incident shows you her resolve. She wasn't just out there as a figurehead who'd turn and run at the first sign of confrontation. She was actually out there standing her ground saying, you know, I'm an American. I'm carrying an American flag. And she actually said, she goes, with the guy with the sword, she goes, run it through me. If this flag won't protect me, nothing will. And she stood her ground.
it took a lot of guts to stand out there and basically make herself the central target of everything that was going on. She was striking. She was out in front. She was the one who was basically saying, if you're going to throw something, throw it at me. I'm right here. Yes. I can handle that. I don't think people understand today, and it shocked me as I did research into this a decade ago. This was basically the Wild West at the time. We had people carrying guns and shooting people. We had strike breakers and thugs, and we had the private cops come in who were just completely ruthless. This was the Wild West for a couple of years.
Yeah, and one of the things that I think is important to point out, there's a book that came out a couple of years ago about Women of the Copper Country, and it focuses a lot on Big Annie, and so it's nice that they focus attention on her in a book that was a national bestseller. But interestingly, in the book, the author does not mention Big Annie being at the funeral, and Big Annie led the funeral, and she actually brought her flagpole with her, and her flag, but she draped it in black, because they're in mourning. And so not only did she lead the parades of the strikers, she actually led the funeral procession out to the Lakeview Cemetery the day of the funerals for the bulk of the victims of the Italian Hall.
Yeah, and what a day that must have been. I know they had to reach out to funeral homes from around the region to try to get coffins shipped in for all of these people, especially little coffins for these children. Afterward, after it happened, they laid the bodies out in the Calumet Theater, and the whole community. What a terrible, terrible thing that must have been. I just can't imagine the angst people must have felt because of that.
And I do presentations about the Italian all the time, and I've got all these photographs I show, and there's a couple famous photographs that are taken at the funerals and at the cemetery, and there are these trench graves. They dug these trench graves, and there's two or three trench graves they dug in the Lakeview Cemetery in December of the 1913. And I put the photograph up on the screen of these trench graves, and I say, that right there is not Central Europe. That right there is not South America. That is Calumet, Michigan, 1913. And it sends up a gasp through the audience, because we're so used to seeing these mass graves elsewhere. And now, this wasn't a mass grave in the sense of dumping in unidentified bodies, but they had to bury 73 people on short notice in the Upper Peninsula in the winter time.
Yeah.
And so it was a necessity, but it's also just shocking to the eye to see that and go, wow, trench graves being dug because it's so many bodies to bury.
Just think about digging the grave in the wintertime up here. We didn't have backhoes at the time. That was all dug by hand in frozen ground.
And I'm sure you know that quite often people who pass away in the wintertime in the UP get buried in the spring because of the logistics of it.
Sure.
And so luckily there were a few thousand unemployed hard rock miners who knew how to swing a pick.
Yeah,
and so they weren't doing anything else, and they went out to the. And I've always thought that that's got to be one of the dramatic things that was not recorded, was the fact that you had a bunch of striking miners out at the cemetery digging these graves because they're on strike and they're burying their own children.
The strike eventually did end. It took a long time for it to get over. It kind of portended the falling off of the copper industry. I have often thought that I think the mine owners, one of the things that they already realized was that the handwriting was on the wall, that the Western mines were going to be taking over as dominant, that the loads that we were mining here were playing out. Obviously, mining, once World War II passed a few years later, mining just began to slow down here. It struck found for a while, but it was really probably the last great dramatic thing that happened in the heyday of the mining operation here in the Copper Country. And the mining operations were never the same after that, even though people did go back to work.
Yeah, and a lot of people did leave the area also. I know that a lot of the workers, rather than going back to work, just moved to Detroit and started working for the car companies. But pretty much when the strike ended, it kind of ended with a whimper. You know, it just kind of ended. People tore up their union cards and went back into work. And they did actually get some concessions. That's one thing people often overlook, is that mine management did agree to some slight concessions with respect to wages and hours, but not anything compared to what the strikers were looking for. But you're right, the depth of those mines, some of those mines were like a mile down, and it started getting, you know, this economical to bring the stuff to the surface because it was so deep. So they realized that, yeah, pretty soon this is going to peter out anyways.
We got to wrap this up. Steve Linto is the author of Death's Door. That book is still available, I'm sure, local bookstores and also online.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And if you have not read it, I certainly recommend it to you. It's the definitive look at the Italian Hall tragedy and at a lot of the other things that went on with the strike as well. Steve, thank you for your time. Good to talk with you again.
Thank you. Nice talking to you, too, as well.